Every Woman is a feminist show about women making a difference and the men by their side. As 50% of the world's population and 52% of eligible U.S. voters, women are not a special interest group, and every woman should work and vote toward nothing less than 50-50 participation in social, political, economic, and environmental arenas. The opinions and views expressed on Every Woman are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of the KKFI board, staff, volunteers, or sponsors of KKFI and the Mid-Coast Radio Project, Incorporated.
That was Amy Bell, and I'm Sharon Lockhart. Also with us today, floating around the studio someplace, are Ebony Johnson and Beth Wilkinson. Sitting here beside me is associate host Elaine Giesel, who has brought a guest, Bob Sommer, author of A Great Fullness. We're going to start off, actually, with Women's E-News, and then we'll go to Elaine and Bob, and then we'll have Money Minute Matters. And go to Ira Harrett to tell us about the Martin Luther King Forum coming up on Monday. But right now, we'll go to Women's E! News.
Headline news for Women's E! News. The United Nations says it uncovered evidence that Burundi's security troops gang-rape women while searching the homes of suspected opposition leaders, BBC reported January 15th. The UN said in a statement that it has 13 documented cases of sexual violence in which security forces separated the women and raped them. President Pierre Nkurunziza's bid for and eventual acquisition of a third term has fostered an escalation in violence in Burundi for months. In addition to these attacks against women, the UN reported that security forces also kidnapped, tortured, and killed dozens of young men. Planned Parenthood has filed a long-awaited federal lawsuit against the anti-choice group Center for Medical Progress, which has targeted Planned Parenthood with undercover videos for the past year, The Hill reported January 14th. Planned Parenthood argued that the Center for Medical Progress has violated federal law as well as the laws of three states by releasing edited, undercover videos of Planned Parenthood staff members discussing fetal tissue donation. Although Planned Parenthood officials have not yet decided how much money to seek in damages, the organization said in its complaint that it is seeking compensatory, statutory, and punitive damages. The American Civil Liberties Union warned listeners about potential restrictions on abortion and provided an overview of 2016 abortion legislation during a January 14th teleconference. In the days leading up to the 43rd anniversary of Roe v. Wade, Jennifer Dalvin, director of the ACLU's Reproductive Freedom Project, discussed an upcoming Supreme Court case, its first major abortion case since 2007. The case is a challenge to a Texas law that would close down 75% of the state's abortion clinics, affect millions of women, and potentially change the constitutional principles governing abortions. The Houston-based Mauston Law Firm has accused Boston Scientific Corporation and three other medical companies of running an international conspiracy that sold defective vaginal surgical mesh made of counterfeit supplies it smuggled from China, PR Newswire reported January 14th. The firm sued these companies under the Racketeering and Corrupt Organizations Act on behalf of women who have experienced severe discomfort, bleeding, infections, and other complications from the plastic mesh implants, the report said. The lawsuit comes on the heels of tighter FDA regulations on surgical mesh products and seeks unspecified damages for the thousands of women who have obtained transvaginal mesh products from Boston Scientific since September 2012. Chinese authorities have formally arrested China's most prominent female human rights lawyer on the basis of alleged subversion, Reuters reported January 13th. Wang Yu has been targeted as part of a crackdown on activists who help others fight for their legal rights. She was taken into custody last July and accused of causing a disturbance. Her arrest comes at a time when hundreds of lawyers have been detained and at least five other human rights lawyers have been formally arrested after being accused of inciting subversion of state power. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, during his State of the State address, vowed to enact pending legislation that would grant 12 weeks of paid leave for workers carrying a new child or sick relative, the Associated Press reported January 13th. His office said this would particularly benefit low-income workers who often lack benefits or job security and, quote, has the potential to serve as a great equalizer for women, end quote. Almost half, 47%, of New York's current workforce consists of women, according to Cuomo's budget proposal. If enacted, New York would only be the fourth state after California, New Jersey, and Rhode Island to offer this benefit. Similarly, Cuomo reiterated his call for the imposition of a $15 minimum wage for workers. He likewise unveiled a $20 billion plan to add 100,000 permanent housing units over 5 years and 20,000 supportive housing beds over 15 years, the New York Times reported January 13th. He also proposed increasing aid to public schools by almost $1 billion to $24.2 billion. Following the uproar over the sexual assault of hundreds of women in Cologne, Germany, reports have surfaced that women in at least three towns in Denmark were also sexually harassed by asylum seekers, RT reported January 13th. Citing information from local officials, the report said some male refugees in Denmark, quote, have a hard time respecting the opposite sex, end quote, while enjoying the local nightlife. Some of the incidents occurred in the towns of Tisten, Sønderborg, and Haderslev, it said. In the aftermath of South Carolina, Governor Nikki Haley's response to President Obama's final State of the Union address, public speculation that Haley will run for president is on the rise. Haley appeared on NBC's Today, January 13th, the morning after her speech, and said that while she, quote, really hasn't thought about running for vice president, she would sit down and talk about it if any of the GOP candidates wanted to do so. Haley has recently been going head-to-head with Republican frontrunner Donald Trump on issues like immigration and told Today's Matt Lawyer that Trump was one of the loud voices she criticized in her speech. Subsequently, Ann Cutler tweeted that Trump should deport Nikki Haley. But many Republicans are open to Haley as vice president because, as Katie Packer, a GOP strategist who worked on Mitt Romney's 2012 presidential bid, told the National Journal, anything we can do to make us less grouchy, less rich, less white, less male, I think that helps us as a party. Bill Cosby has filed a motion before a Pennsylvania court to dismiss the sexual assault charges against him, the Huffington Post reported January 12th. The lawyers of Cosby, who was charged of drugging and sexually assaulting a woman in 2004, said the charges violate an express agreement made by the Montgomery County District Attorney in 2005, where they agreed that the actor would not be prosecuted with respect to the allegations of sexual assault made by complainant Andrea Costin. Cosby is also accused of sexually assaulting more than 50 other women, but these are the only criminal charges filed against him. Cosby is currently out on a $1 million bail.
That was Ebony Johnson reading Women's E-News, and now we're going to turn this over to Elaine Giesel, and she's going to introduce Bob Sommer, author of A Great Fullness.
Thank you, Sharon. And Bob and I are associated, both of us, with Sierra Club Work. That's how I met Bob originally. But we have him here as a guest to discuss a new book that he is now out there for people to read. And it does deal largely with the role of women in society today and the future, and some domestic violence issues as well. We're going to talk to him about what pushed him to write this book, how he got the information, and we'll go through a series of questions. All right? Bob, tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, Elaine and Sharon and Amy, thanks for having me, first of all. I appreciate it. And I currently spend most of my time working with the Sierra Club in Kansas, and I also teach at the University of St. Mary, and the balance of my time I spend writing.
And you teach as well?
I do. I teach composition and literature at the University of St. Mary.
Which is fun always, isn't it? The teaching part of it. I've been there myself.
It has its challenges. Sure.
Well, let's get into your book. What is the title of the book?
A Gratefulness. It's the title is actually taken from a line in a poem by Robert Penn Warren, who I've just been an admirer of his poetry for 35 years. And I actually included in the book the epigraph, as an epigraph, the fragment from which that came. And I'd be glad to share that
with you.
I have been in a place where nothing is. It is not silence, for there are voices. Not emptiness, for there is a gratefulness. And that's from Robert Penn Warren's poem, A Place Where Nothing Is.
And it helps one get through the book thinking about this. I mean, I it helped me as I was reading and thinking through, why would you call this a gratefulness? And there's an interesting cover on the book, too, and it is from a painting.
That's right. The painting is on the cover of the book is from the Edward Hopper painting, Rooms for Tourists, and we were very fortunate to find it. We had permission from the Yale University Museum in order to be able to reprint it. It just seemed to, when I saw it, I knew instantly that this was the right cover for
it. Why?
Well, the book itself is set, the story is mostly set in a bed and breakfast in a small Kansas town could conceivably not too far from here. It's set in eastern Kansas. The story is based on an incident of domestic violence. That really is what sets it in motion. I'll just share a little background on that. About 20 years ago, a coworker shared an anecdote with me, that had happened in which this, this unmarried couple is living together, and they had a child, the man murdered the mother of this child, and he went to prison. She was adopted by an aunt and uncle. And that anecdote, I mean, that was as much as I needed to kind of, I didn't even know at the time that it would be a book. It wasn't until 15 years later that I returned to the story. And I was kind of like, thinking about it, too, it was kind of like there's an anecdote about Henry James when he's at a dinner party one time, and this woman is sitting next to him, and she knows that he's a novelist and a story writer, and she tells him something, and this would make a great story. And he said, yes, it would. And so she starts to tell him more about it, and he covers his ears and said, don't tell me anymore. I don't want to know any more than that. And so that's kind of how this incident set things in motion.
Well, you said that there was, domestic violence. Someone, a partner killed the woman, and the daughter was adopted. Who would you call the protagonist of the story then?
Well, the protagonist is the child. Her name is Kim. And she's 4 years old, kind of at the outset of the book. And the book is very much a coming-of-age story about Kim. It takes her through her life into her, middle to late teenage years. She's surrounded by, she's brought up in by an aunt and uncle who manage a bed and breakfast. And so that's why going back to the question, that's why the cover for the book, which is Rooms for Tourists. And so the bed and breakfast provides this sort of occasion for all these people to come and go in the household, and provides a kind of both sense of disorientation and exploration for her.
Right, and rather shallow relationships. I mean, they're the house is full, so to speak, the great fullness, but it's also empty. We find that she's often hiding, being by herself and not connecting with all the different individuals who come in and out of her life, which is interesting. We thought we might read a passage to kind of introduce Kim and what she is facing. I think on page 29 was where I had suggested.
Sure. In this instance, there's a wedding going on in the house, and it's the night before the wedding. So all of the guests are doing the things that they do, the bridal party and so forth, and they're drinking and they're partying and so forth. And Kim has already been put to bed. She lives up on the third floor with her family, and so her room is dark, and but still outside and throughout the house, she can hear all the noises. And it's one of those moments of quiet and aloneness in which she's sort of in a process of self-discovery as well. Kim rubs the silky edge of the blanket between her fingers. Darkness is its own kind of light, surrounding the night glows light. Darkness is its own kind of light, surrounding the night light's glow. She lies awake, listening, content to listen and reassemble the sounds, identify the voices, imagine the bright rooms filled with people and chatter. A puzzle, a story. Like before she came here, a story in fragments that come out of the darkness through the hum of sounds all over the house. If she thinks hard enough, it will come back. She'll remember what came before this. In the hazy, fragile way a six-year-old may find a purpose for living, this is hers. To find out why everything changed. To fill in the images and sounds that surround the fragments. The clues are all around her, she suspects. If she can just recognize them when she sees them. If she thinks hard enough, it will come back. She'll know why Daddy's gone and Mommy's dead.
And that sort of sets a premise for the book, her exploration, and as she grows older, finding various pieces and starting to put it back together. It makes you keep reading. I mean, you want to see ultimately the outcome.
Well, I appreciate that. And you know, she's very much on the outside. I find her... It was a process of discovery for me about this child because she doesn't her problem is or her challenge is that she doesn't feel like she fits anywhere. Something has happened to her that's different from everybody else, and she's also in a place suddenly wakes up in a place where everything has changed. Mommy's gone. Mommy is dead, and Daddy is gone, and the people that she knew are gone, and she's isolated. And then to compound that is the issue of all these people who come and go in the household as well.
Right. Because domestic violence comes up in several places in the book. I mean, it isn't just that one incident that we read about this, but it in some ways recurring. I mean, their grandmother's husband, first husband, which is referred to as the animal.
The animal.
I mean, he has no name other than that.
Right.
This is a theme of the book. What led you down that path?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. I'm not sure I knew I was going down that path. I mean, I had this incident that set the book in motion that I wanted to. It's kind of like the notion you see on Law and Order, of, you know, ripped from the headlines. Well, I had this this kind of kernel of an idea, and I didn't really set out to write a book about domestic violence. But what I did want to do was to set the story in the period of the late 90s and the early part of the millennium, when the country and the world, but our country, was going through this kind of change. You know, you think about the late 1990s, and life is good. There was the beer commercial, life is good, and we were prosperous, and we were spending all kinds of money, and the Clintons were in office, and all of that sort of thing. And then what happened was when the millennium changed, we had this immense tragedy that took place. And everything seemed to change after that. But, you know, the reality of it is, at least the way I perceive it, is that this tragedy occurred on 9/11, and America did not respond very well in the long run. And so there was this kind of cultural sense of melancholy and decline. America became very self-pitying, became very jingoistic, became very nationalistic. A lot of things really did not come out well. We went to war. We went to war again. All of this sort of thing. So I wanted to depict the kind of cultural environment that surrounded the family. And the family in this house, in this bed and breakfast, in Monarch House it's called, becomes a sort of emblem of that, and they sort of are living through it. So to go back to the idea of domestic violence, in some ways, I think, you know, that becomes an emblem of the larger tragedy. And at the same time, you know, I found myself exploring or trying to understand exactly what happens. And in a sense, the idea of domestic violence, you know, we think of maybe one victim, but in a sense, this was more like throwing a rock into or boulder into a pond, and it doesn't ripple, it splashes, because so many people are affected by domestic violence. I didn't want to write a scholarly book about domestic violence, and I think that writers who often try to write a book about just a social issue often get into trouble because their characters will end up just being very, very flat. So this is a book about people. And yet at the same time, I learned some interesting things. I mean, this one incident to me had been so prominent, you know. And yet, in the course of things, I learned that 3,000 children a year in America are orphaned in this way. I mean, the numbers are appalling. I discovered that in California alone, 900,000 children have incarcerated parents. So there was just a very larger scale, you know, issue involved with it. But that was kind of where I was trying to pursue it.
Well, I'm glad you did, because my question was going to be whether you'd seen some kind of cultural shift, some societal norms that had, you know, appropriate for that era, because you have talked about, there are parts of the book devoted to exploring what's going on inside the prison with the dad, mm-hmm. who has been incarcerated.
Yep.
And who has lost his parental rights, and I think that's interesting. And you alluded to the fact that may have been a part of that initial case, that the courts decided you could actually do that?
Yes,
yes.
In Kansas, a parent who kills a spouse or the parents of another child loses parental rights.
Right, yes. So there's a legal matter. But there's also, there are drugs involved. There is prison. There are the cultural shifts. There's also shifting demographics, which seem to play a role here. And, well, without giving anything away, the difference in the Latino culture that arises and actually provides a parallel situation, if you will, that leads to a lot of different things. But the country has been changing, and I think it was interesting that you said it in that period of time.
Well, I think that what I wanted to do, in a sense, in you're referring to minority communities and so forth, is to kind of break down or show how these barriers of whiteness and, you know, urban and suburban insulation were kind of being penetrated and breaking down. That made it very uncomfortable for a lot of people, and a lot of new dynamics were emerging. There is, for example, an Ethiopian couple who are immigrants in the country, and they are part of the story. And some illegal immigrants who befriend the child as well. So there's a lot going on in the relationships that she ends up developing along
right,
the way.
Right. Right. Exactly. I guess it allows us to ask, knowing that the situation was not new that Kim's mother found herself in, is why do women not take steps? Why don't they leave? In this case, the couple were not even married.
Mm-hmm.
They had the child together. But it's a question that we ask ourselves often. Maybe Sharon wants to comment here, too, is that women know when they're in a bad place. It usually isn't the first instance when they're killed. There's been abuse and violence before. What is it about our society that doesn't encourage women to make a change, to save their own lives often, or the lives of their children in some cases? Have you run into this, Sharon, where, you know, what's the answer? How do we get women to see the situation?
Well, I happen to have personal experience with this. I'm not sure my microphone's on. Let me use your mic. I'm just not sure.
I happen to have personal experience with this, and it's the embarrassment of it, admitting you made a mistake, feeling like you're in a relationship and you may be financially caught up in it and there is no option for you. And so I think those are some of the reasons that people stay, maybe financial, and then the women often say, "But I love him. I love him."
Mm-hmm.
I went through lots of counseling myself based on that.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, yeah, you see this in the book too. Where, what was your feeling, and how do you write your character so that they don't leave?
Well, yeah, I think that in one of the ways to answer that is to say that a lot happens off stage. And I should just back up in that regard and tell you that the original manuscript was about 550 pages, and it's the editor at Fomite Press, who is terrific, by the way, Mark Estrin, he really gave me some very interesting and great guidance in this, but he wanted about 150 pages cut from the book. And we had some interesting back and forths about that as well. All of them very collegial, I have to say, but he turned out to be right. But in answer to your question, some of that happens off stage. You know, it's kind of, because of the fact that there is just simply this kind of for want of a better word, norm that women do stay in these relationships, I just kind of went with that. And so, you know, off stage, maybe there would have been conversations that her sister would have had. Her sister is the owner of the bed and breakfast, that her sister would have had with her about, you know, you got to leave him and so forth. But instead, she just provides a kind of refuge at times for when that woman needs to go there.
I was going to say, the sister really doesn't provide anything but refuge. And that's not a lot of advice so far as we can tell. And her own relationship is interesting, too. You don't find any of the couples in the book meeting what we might think of as their ideal couple. Mm-hmm. I mean, the aunt and her husband, Nick, they're very busy with their business.
Yes.
Let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the level at which you see them working together as partners, but, you know, that interpersonal thing doesn't seem to be there. And from there, it kind of goes downhill with some of the other couples.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just
yeah.
put it that way.
And another reason that women stay, too, is because the person may be very cunning, and she believes it's her fault. I mean, if she could just do something right, this would all change, and she just keeps hoping for it to improve.
I think there's still physical threats, too, and I think Bob captured that pretty well in portraying the mother and the father of the child is being unequal physically, which makes it tough. I mean,
well, and one thing that does come out is that the child in this case is also the kind of the stake for the woman. She's afraid that she won't get to take her daughter with her if she leaves,
right.
And so that's kind of the one of the things that binds her there as well. But you know, it's really interesting that you mention all these dynamics of the relationships, because one of the things that one of the things you could easily wonder is about a man writing about women, and there's obviously plenty of precedent for that from Henry James and Hawthorne and many others in literary history, but. One of the things that I discovered, and this was kind of after the fact, it wasn't in the process of writing, it was kind of after the fact, looking back at the book and as I was, you know, revising it and so forth, was that the women in the book are, I think, the ones who evolve. They're the ones who develop more as characters and as people, whereas the men in the book, especially in the kind of relationships that they're in, tend to be more static. And that wasn't intentional. It wasn't something that I was trying to do. I wasn't trying to create a message or anything like that with it. It was just how it evolved. But what I wanted to be able to show with some of the women, and maybe this is why they were somewhat richer, is looking at the kind of the consequences, the tragic consequences and unintended consequences for so many people. And one example is the mother of the perpetrator, of the felon, that suddenly she loses her granddaughter. I mean, here she did not do this, and so there's even a reference at points in the book to the sins of the son being visited on the mother, you know, that this woman is desperate to try and regain a relationship, and the circumstances that, you know, kind of follow something like this, a crime of this nature, create all kinds of other antagonisms that make that very difficult.
And did you say that mother of Kim's mother, the daughter, that she herself is abused, the grandmother?
Yes, she was. She's actually in her second marriage. And her first marriage, the father of the guy who does the who was the murderer, was also an abuser as well. Good point.
Yeah. And that tends to carry on the cycles,
right? And I think that's brought out in the book. And the good news is that there's a great deal said too about human resilience, and Kim's ability through her own strength. Is able to resolve and come to some reconciliation.
She is, and I think that one of the things that happens with her is that the way that she exists in all of this, or in much of the story as it's told until near the end, is that she is an entity unto herself, and everything around her is strange. Everything, you know, she is completely existing within herself. So much of the, you know, what goes on with her is internal, and everything is strange. And so therefore, there are no rules for what there should be outside of herself. And so there are all these constructs that she has to figure out how to exist within, whether it's school or there's a back and forth even. I mean, this is kind of just what you'd expect in puberty. There's a back and forth about wearing the bra, you know, at one point, and this kind of thing. But she resists things. And it's a trait that also, as is suggested in the narrative, that carries over from her mother. While her mother is the victim, her mother is not necessarily a saint either. And I try to create an atmosphere in which everybody has, you know, is real to a degree. Her mother is also a difficult person to live with. That's not in any way to suggest that any violence should be brought down on her. It's just that these traits ultimately end up giving Kim strength.
Right. We're going to break for a minute, come back to Bob and talk about some of his other projects.
And let's, before we go, let's talk about where we can find out more information about the book.
Oh, sure. Well, first of all, please do find me on Facebook and on Goodreads. And I'd love to have some new friends and readers there. My blog is Uncommon Hours, and the book is available through Fomite Press, Fomite.
And that's A Great Fullness.
A Great Fullness, yes.
A Great
thank
Fullness.
You.
And we're back with Elaine Diesel, who's going to reintroduce.
Right, I'm introducing again my guest, Bob Sommer, and that's Sommer, if you're looking for him out there on Facebook or anywhere else. And we've been talking about Bob's new book, A Great Fullness. We're going to wrap up our interview talking about maybe some of your past efforts and whether you have any other future projects online.
Well, my first book is called Where the Wind Blew, and that's about a 1960s radical. That was published in 2008, and that's out there as well and available. And I'm currently working on my current project is a series of essays. We lost a son 5 years ago. He had served in Afghanistan and in Iraq as well, and I've been publishing a series of essays about him, and that I'll be collecting into a book. And those you can actually read some of those. They've been, several of them have been published, and that's available at my blog, Uncommon Hours.
And Uncommon Hours. Okay. And I know also that you and your wife, Heather, have been working through this son's cookbook and preparing recipes. And I've had an opportunity to actually enjoy some of Francis's recipes. And that, I assume, has been a positive experience.
An amazing experience. And she's become an amazing cook. He was late in the program at Johnson County Community College in the culinary program. And he was a chef here at one of the local restaurants. And he left over 100 recipes that she's been working up into a cookbook.
An amazing experience. So the book is available. Is it at retail outlets? No, just available through the publisher now?
It is available at several local independent shops and as well through the publisher and Amazon and other online locations.
All right. Any last words? Do you have something brief you want to read to us?
I'd be glad to share one more passage
all
at
right.
this time. In this passage, Kim is, I think I turned to the wrong page. In this passage, Kim is now at, she's at, several of the scenes are set locally, and this one happens to be at the old Jones store, which was located at Metcalf South. Some people will remember that. And she was taken shopping here by her grandmother, and she's left alone at a counter. And there's a little bit of a dramatic moment that kind of gives you a glimpse of some of the issues that are going on with her. But she's, this is very disorienting for her to be in this big department store because her aunt and uncle never take her to places like this. So she's at the counter, at the jewelry counter. The trays under the counter gleamed in gold and silver and stones in all the colors of the 64 box of crayons, seemed like. She wondered what the names of the stones were and where they got dug up and who dug them and did they find them in some big mountain of electric lime or razzle-dazzle rose or mango tango. The whole place was like that, so much stuff, so much of it. And how eager and desperate and even angry some of the people were as they rustled through the clothing racks and the way they talked to clerks like, show me this and give me that. And they just point and talk to clerks like they were slaves or whatever. The earrings hung on little white cards that dangled and rustled when the rack spun. She wiggled it, sending a ripple through the rack. One pair shook loose and landed face down on the counter. She turned it over, holding the card in the palm of her hand. The label said emerald, but she thought screaming green. The color reminded her of oak leaves in summertime, layered on top of one another, thick and rich, how they fluttered when a breeze lifted them. The noise and chaos all around seemed to melt away in the color. She now realized how noisy it was here, a constant hum and rumble that surrounded her ever since they arrived. But now, as she studied the rich color of the earrings, the noise became faint and distant. It was the color. It sucked the racket in and concentrated it in a lambent glow. She cupped the card with the earrings into her palm and slid it into her jeans pocket. And just then, Gammy emerged from between the clothing racks across the aisle with Papa.
Thank you, Bob. All right, Sharon, we're going to turn the show back over to you. I appreciate Bob coming here and sharing his insights, and we'll let you have the show.
Thank you very much, Bob, for coming, and your book sounds very interesting. I can't wait for it to be on audio.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And now we're going to go to our Money Matters Minute.
Investment 101, Part 1. From wiserwomen.org, Women's Institute for Secure Retirement. Learn how to invest wisely in bonds, mutual funds, and other investment vehicles. Here are some basic information to get you started. There are three basic places where you can invest your money. First, cash. Includes certificates of bonds, CDs, and money market funds. Cash does not earn enough interest to keep its value due to inflation. 2. Bonds, a certificate of debt from a company or government, includes treasury bills, and mutual funds can also include municipal, corporate, and/or government bonds. Number 3. Stocks. A share in a company, mutual funds can include stocks known as large caps, mid caps, or small caps that replace the size of large, middle size, or small companies, to be included next week. For more information, go to Wiser Women, WISERWOMEN.org.
And now we're on the air with Ira Harrod, and he's going to talk to us about the upcoming Martin Luther King event this Monday. Ira, welcome.
Well, good to be here. Thank you.
And how many Martin Luther King events have we have you been involved with lately or in the past?
Well, we do an annual Martin Luther King Forum, and what makes this event perhaps a little different than some of the others is it doesn't just celebrate Dr. King's life and some of the things that he did, but it focuses on the call for radical social change and how we can create greater economic justice in the world, and raises up what people are doing. So it really is meant to face the issues that challenge us. And this year the theme is moving the money, concrete steps for economic justice for all people.
And is this from, there was an excerpt from a speech of his, I think, on the top of the flyer.
That's right. The excerpt is, in a sense, we have come to our nation's capital to cash a check. And so that comes from his I Had a Dream speech at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. And so he was speaking, at least in my kind of frame of mind, about the social contract that our government has with its people. And he pointed out that our founders had made this contract and promised life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But at that time, he was particularly focusing on how people of color, especially African American citizens, had been had missed the opportunity, or hadn't been, that promise had not been fulfilled. And I'd say that today we have more and more people that are being left out, and that it's time to call upon our government to fulfill that promise. Even though some would say that smaller government is better, really the government has this role to help fulfill this promise.
I was tuned into some of the Republican debate the other night, and you know, their continued cry for cutting taxes and how the corporations pay such large tax percentages. And it's just so ridiculous. I mean, cutting taxes for the wealthy is not doing anything for the average person.
I watched the Republican debate, too, and I have to say, I didn't think they even took themselves seriously.
Well, that's interesting that you say that, because it wasn't anything
substantial. It was one-liners. They were slap-happy. I've never seen a presidential debate that I would call slap-happy.
Well, anybody else have a comment to make about it? Ira, did you watch it?
I missed the debate.
Oh, you! I know. It was painful. I know. I know. It was pretty ridiculous overall. They didn't even touch on anything.
But and part of what there's going to be a number of speakers kind of addressing this issue of moving the money from different perspectives. And one that the American Friends Service Committee is going to be speaking to is this whole narrative or worldview that we are kind of that is marketed to the American public, and what you're speaking about decreasing taxes for the 1% and the mega corporations, and the myth that is somehow going to increase people's wages and jobs and so forth, is blatantly false and has been proved to be false. Since it was proposed, the whole idea of trickle-down economics from the Reagan years.
With a lot of some of the one-liners, as Amy mentioned, in just different commentary, if you will, it seems that we're just trying to avoid doing something new that we need to do. Instead of, like in some ways where you want to just keep tweaking something or taking care of the symptom instead of really just getting to the heart core of the matter. Some people say, oh, let's cut taxes, oh, let's raise taxes, oh, let's do this. And in some ways, I just wonder, well, we keep talking around the taxes instead of just talking about our system in general, and if we are just playing to an outdated system that no longer serves us.
Well, Dr. King said that a system that creates beggars needs restructuring. And so whether you believe in another system beyond capitalism, or you believe that capitalism can be restructured in a way to serve all people, we definitely need to have our government serve the people and have the systems that are in place function for the benefit of all members of society, not just the 1%. And I think it's very clear, and I don't think it's a secret for most people, and that is that the government really serves the needs of the richest, most powerful people in our society, and has failed to meet the needs of the average person. And so what the Spinmeisters have done is they've used that as cause to attack government, but really that just gives if we shrink government and make it less able to function or impact our lives, what we really do is we just put more power into the hands of the rich and powerful, so that they can keep wages low and they can benefit from whatever structures in society, that allow them to then create more profits, and it's sometimes it's kind of sort of dismantling those kinds of systems. So you dismantle public education so that it can become a profit-making source for people, or you create private prisons, or even you just contract with the military or the prison industrial complex or what have you.
I have a question that is kind of, it almost feels like the type of question that you're just not supposed to ask in America. And I'm wondering that with the idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, do you think that Dr. King felt that the Constitution was not adequate in this country?
I don't know that he was making that statement, but I do know that he raised the point that it was not being, it was not serving all members of the community, and in particular, African Americans were left out of what the Constitution and what the Declaration of Independence, the vision that those kinds of documents had, were not reaching.
So it was more enforcement than the actual legal principles.
Well,
that were
I think
there.
It was both. That he spoke to changing laws, and he also spoke to the application of laws in a more just, equitable kind of way.
Let's tell our listeners where they can attend this forum on Monday.
Well, the forum is on Monday from 3:30 to 5 at Metropolitan Missionary Baptist Church, which is at 2310 East Linwood Boulevard. And so it precedes the Mass celebration, which is an annual event that will take place at 6 o'clock. And actually, I got distracted, and you had asked how long we had been doing this event, and it's been 10 or 15 years that we've been holding these annual forums.
And who are your panelists this year?
Well, we have some great people speaking. We have a Dr. Angela Sims, who's at St. Paul School of Theology. She's a dean and associate professor of ethics and Black church studies. And she'll be speaking about some of the moral and ethical issues that would speak to how we distribute wealth the structures we have that are in place in our society that address wage and wealth and income, etc. And then we have Laura McDonald from Moore Squared, who will talk about all the work that Moore Squared is doing for economic and racial justice. And we had Terrence Wise scheduled to be on the panel, but actually he had the honor of being asked to attend some actions and meetings in Europe. So he's just come back, I believe, and he's not going to be able to be with us on Sunday, but we will have...
Or Monday.
Monday. We will have Richard Eicher from Stand Up KC, who's a fast food worker at McDonald's and a fast food worker leader and organizer. And then we have Kelsey Barris, who's the president of the Rockhurst Black Student Union, and she'll be commenting on how these issues are particularly relevant to young people and how they can work for economic justice. And then I'm honored to have been asked to participate in the panel as well. And I'm the program coordinator for the American Friends Service Committee. And I'll be commenting. Actually, the theme is moving the money. And so I'll be commenting on our campaign that we've been involved with over the past 7 or 8 years, entitled Move the Money. And it was a response to the Great Recession and how our leaders were responding. And instead of addressing the problems and trying to fix the issues that were of concern, instead they focused on things like the deficit and used that as an excuse to cut social programs and cut taxes and basically pursue an agenda that had nothing to do with the causes of the Great Recession. And so we'll also share a new statement that has been developed by some of the leaders we spoke with in a listening project about community needs and policies that would best address those needs. And so it's actually a new statement that speaks to changing the narrative about social issues that frame policy debates. And individuals and leaders are invited to endorse the statement. Basically, we want to mobilize a mass of people to feel empowered and to speak out with a common voice, so that when an elected official or a candidate says, "Oh, we've got to cut taxes so that the job creators can, you know, put us back to work," that the people's voice overwhelms that false statement. And the media just can't get away with, you know, giving it a pass or even taking it seriously and supporting it and giving it more energy.
And I see your moderator is Dr. Vernon Howard of Southern Christian Leadership Council of Greater Kansas City.
That's right. He's a fabulous speaker, has great insight, and so he's the moderator, but I'm sure we'll hear some wisdom coming from him as well.
Well, you know, back to the social ills and lack of jobs, and when we heard President Obama speak the other night, I was just all fired up and said, yes, this is a great country. Yes, things are getting better. And then I listened to the Republicans, and they said, oh, that's not true. None of that is true. And I don't know, maybe somewhere in the middle. I think we're probably still having a lot of problems because I think there's still a lot of people without work and underemployed people because they lost good-paying jobs.
There was a story in the Kansas City Star just this past Friday which reported on a study of it was based on in particular cities, but I think can be generalized to across the country, and it looked at wages of the lowest 20% income in our society compared to the top 5%, and so in these various cities across the board, the low wage workers had lost ground, and so they were making less than they were before the recession hit, and the 5%ers were doing fine. And so, so though there's progress, and though people aren't as bad off as in the depths of the recession, or many people, unfortunately, a lot of the jobs lost have been replaced by low-wage jobs or jobs that don't pay as much, while dividends and capital gains have been great, and upper wage workers have gained.
Well, and I heard a statement, I don't know where, probably from the Republicans. Well, the reason that it hasn't worked so far is because the 1% were investing their money in the stock market because interest rates were so low. And I'm not sure how that equates to anything changing going forward, but that was just a statement that was put out there. There are all these words out there that really, if you think about it critically, they mean nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just at a loss to even begin to understand how anything can improve. Are we running out of time?
We're coming close, but we're still okay. But I do think, to your point, Sharon, it is hard to try and convince people that no, this is going to work, this is okay, if it hasn't worked for them, their parents, their parents' parents, their parents' parents. Like, at some point you say, okay, when is this going to work for me too?
That's a very good point. We're still waiting.
And I think what the those on the right, or those who are supporting the corporate and 1% elite agenda, they want us to be jealous of one another. They want us to be afraid of one another. They want us to say, well, yes, maybe we should do this. Oh, but it's not practical. We can't do that.
They want us to fight when police officers are killing unarmed people instead of come together and put a stop to that.
Exactly. There was, I think, Karl Rove once made a statement during the Bush years, and he said that he was happy anytime he saw progressive people doing anti-war demonstrations, because that meant that they weren't pursuing their own positive agenda. And so we have to stop just fighting, you know, and opposing the bad policies that are hurting citizens and the average person, the most of us, and instead kind of have this vision and start working to implement that. And that's just not this immediate policy agenda level, but we have to also build our strength and sort of the infrastructure so that we can set the agenda. And it's not something that's going to happen in a year or 2 years or 3 years. It's something that we really need to look at in the long term, 10, 20, 30 years down the road, so that we have a healthy society for all people and don't have to settle for the scraps that the elites will give us.
Tell us again, where should we be on Monday at 3:30?
Monday, 3:30, Metropolitan Missionary Baptist Church, 2310 East Linwood Boulevard, Kansas City, Missouri, for the Move the Money Concrete Steps for Economic Justice for All People, Martin Luther King Holiday Forum. We usually have a couple hundred people there, great panel members offering comments. A dozen or more groups will be tabling, and we encourage you to come, and there'll be questions and answers and a good discussion as well.
Thank you so much, Ira Harrod, Executive Director of the American Friends Service Committee.
Thank you.
You work hard in this community, I know for a fact.
And make sure that you stay tuned for Urban Connections with Donna Wolf and guess who's coming to Kansas City with MC Richardson.